Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by the Netflix original documentary, Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Following a high-stakes legal battle over a celebrity sex tape, this documentary explores the shadowed world of billionaires undermining democracy, now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, June 26th, 2017. And remember, you can keep the conversation going at The Takeaway's Facebook page.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin this week with tantalizing hints from a Supreme Court with a brand new justice, Neil Gorsuch, as the court recesses for the summer. 2 years after the historic summer when the court legalized the right to marry by same-sex couples, the court announced it will hear President Trump's travel ban cases in the fall. The lower courts had blocked the ban from taking effect, but today the high court said there was no reason for most of the injunctions blocking the ban to remain in effect until a final decision later this year. That's big. The administration can prevent anyone from the six Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. unless they, quote, have a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. Also, the court will look at a wedding cake, a religious conviction, and whether a same-sex wedding can be disrupted by a religious baker. It's actually called the Baker case. Here with the latest is Eric Citron, partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan, and a guest contributor to SCOTUS blog. Eric, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Has the court really intervened here in this travel ban with the vacating of these injunctions?
Well, it's agreed to hear the case, so it's taking it up, and that's intervention of a form. It's also struck down the injunctions in part, which will modify what was happening on the ground. If you have a concrete connection to the United States, you're still protected by the injunction, and so you cannot be banned from entering under the terms of the executive order. But for foreign nationals who have no concrete connection to the United States, the Supreme Court has struck down the lower court's injunction, and they are now subject to the immediate effect of the president's travel ban.
Now, does the injunctions going away diminish the argument or the urgency of the argument of the plaintiffs in these cases?
It's a complicated question. I mean, if the travel ban starts running right now, it's possible that the 90 days will have totally elapsed by the time the court even takes up the case, in which case it will be what lawyers call moot.
Right.
There'll be nothing left to decide. If the Supreme Court thinks that's happened and it's asked for briefing on whether the case has in fact been mooted in the interim, it may just eliminate all of the decisions below and kick the cases out of court, or it could leave the decisions below in place and just kick its own case out of court. All that is sort of hard to predict.
And what is the issue that the court seems to be tantalized with, aside from just wanting to possibly settle things between the plaintiffs and the Trump administration, given all of the rhetorical chaos surrounding travel bans and terrorism and immigration, that sort of thing? Is there due process for people who are traveling with various kinds of papers coming in and out of the U.S.?
Well, I think what the court has done is tried to say very little on the merits of the case. The opinion for the court, which is for six justices, really just focuses on the balance of equities, who's more harmed by setting up the status quo one way or another while we wait for the court to decide the case. So they're really focused on that question, and they don't say anything really about the merits, about what you were discussing, the rhetoric surrounding it. Is this really a religiously motivated ban on Muslim entry? Is it a national security ban? Does it serve a legitimate state purpose if it's been characterized that way? Or are we smoking out religious discrimination? There's nothing about that in the orders today.
We got rulings today. We also got, as the travel ban is one, an indication of what's going to be heard in the next term. How different is the Baker case, and you can describe what this is, than the Hobby Lobby case, where you've got an employee claiming that they can deny service to a customer on the basis of a religious commitment or a religious conviction?
Yeah, it's different for a couple of reasons. One is it's not under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So it's not statutory. It'd be a constitutional claim, which makes it more profound. And the other is, of course, that it's not the employer claiming that they don't want to cover something, which seems much more about their own behavior or payment connection in that respect. It does seem more like discriminating against one of your customers on a, you know, as someone who typically serves everybody in the public. And, you know, that is a rehash of an issue that the court confronted in the 60s about the Civil Rights Act, when it barred, you know, people who provide ordinary common carrier type services from discriminating on the basis of race. And so it is definitely a step beyond Hobby Lobby, and it will be a very substantial ruling if the court ends up finding that there is a constitutional protection there.
And we should just outline that the Baker case is, can a wedding cake baker deny service to same-sex couples? And we're looking at the two-year anniversary of the Supreme Court affirming of a right to same-sex couples to get married.
Yeah, and just to be super clear about it, because I think it's helpful, the Constitution doesn't say whether they can or can't, absent some state law in this instance that purports to say you cannot discriminate against homosexuals in that way or homosexual marriages in that way. The question is, do you have a constitutional defense to the state law that says you have to serve everybody? And that's what makes it much more extreme in that respect. The state has gone out of its way to protect these people. And the question is, can you deny them service anyway?
Any other indications from this last bit of data coming out of the Supreme Court? It's always mysterious. You've described it as that. This is the first final rulings until fall experience with Neil Gorsuch on the court.
You know, if you were trying to place Justice Gorsuch on a kind of left-right axis, he seems to be, from this first set of data, to the right of the Chief Justice, which means that if Justice Kennedy, the current sort of midpoint justice, if he does retire in the next year or two, you can expect Roberts to become the court's swing vote and Chief Justice at the same time, which will make him a very, very powerful voice on the court. That said, Justice Gorsuch did vote with the more liberal position on a case, just kind of a nothing burger of a case about remanding when the government has confessed error. And so there may be some situations, maybe involving the criminal law, where you might see Justice Gorsuch having more of the swing vote.
Eric Citron, thanks so much.
Yep, nice to be here.
Eric Citron, partner at Goldstein & Russell, also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan. The Senate showed off its health care plan last week, joining a different House version that's been kicking around since May. The president, after great interest in repealing Obamacare in his first 100 days, says he's now waiting for something to show up on his desk for him to sign, with a weekend to absorb what this Senate bill might do for or not do for millions of Americans. Lawmakers are starting to register their reactions, and unlike the weeks of Senate closed-door meetings, we're hearing a loud blowback from Republicans and Democrats. The steep cuts to Medicaid and tax breaks for wealthy Americans are being evaluated for a cost score by the Congressional Budget Office. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says plenty of folks on Capitol Hill, though, aren't waiting for the price sticker to pile on their disapproval. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So lots of people, both sides of the aisle, ready to say, not for me.
That's already happening. Look, only one side of the aisle matters here, and that's the Republican side. These Senate rules, as you know, only require Republican votes, and that's all they're going to get. There won't be any Democrats signing onto this. So let's talk about the Republicans and Mitch McConnell's mission to get to 50 votes here. Now, he can only lose two Republican senators and still have Mike Pence, the vice president and president of the Senate, in his back pocket in order to pass this health care bill. It's starting to look tough. There are still deals to be made and amendments to be agreed to. But John, right now, there are already five Republican senators who've said publicly they don't like this bill to varying degrees. Rand Paul of Kentucky looks like he's a hard no. There are some other senators who say they are open to changes. But the problem problem here is that a lot of these senators aren't all on the same side. There are too many senators who don't like it, but some are really, really conservative, some are moderates, and Mitch McConnell doesn't have margin for error. Now, the first thing that we're looking for as early as today, that CBO score that you mentioned, it's vital here. It's going to tell us not only the cost of the bill, it's going to tell us how many millions of Americans are likely to lose insurance over the 10-year life, the scorable life of this bill. That's going to be vital politically. It's going to be bad news for Mitch McConnell. The question is, how bad is the news and can he manage it? Here is Susan Collins. She's a moderate Republican senator from Maine. She was on ABC television over the weekend. I have two cuts for you to play for you here, John, talking about the anticipation of this score and some of her difficulties with this bill.
The CBO analysis quantifying the cuts and the impact is going to be so important.
So important to Susan Collins, and here's why.
I want to wait to see the CBO analysis, but I have very serious concerns about the bill.
Is it just spending that she's concerned about?
Susan Collins is mostly concerned about Medicaid. She's one of the senators, and she's not alone, who come from a state that has an aging population with pretty low income. The health care of people in her state is highly dependent on Medicaid. She has been critical not only of the rollback in the Medicaid expansion that's in this Senate bill, but also how Medicaid is funded in the out years. The Senate bill really slows down Medicaid funding to a point that over as the years pile up, John, amounts to a huge cut for the long-term life of Medicaid. Now, Mitch McConnell could solve that problem. He could go to Susan Collins and say, well, we'll tweak the formula for you and maybe for Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, who agrees with you, and give Medicaid some more money in the out years. That might make Susan Collins happy. But then there's a whole group of conservatives on the other side. I mentioned Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee of Utah, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who would all turn around and say, that's big government. That's too much money. That's too much government spending. And then you might lose them off the other end. Here's Ron Johnson. He was on Meet the Press on NBC. He's come out against this bill much more strongly than a lot of people anticipated.
I have a hard time believing Wisconsin constituents or even myself will have enough time to properly evaluate this for me to vote for a motion to proceed. So I've been encouraging leadership, the White House, anybody I can talk to for quite some time, let's not rush this process. Let's have the integrity to show the American people right. What it is.
And I mean, is he really going to stick with this vote this way? I mean, there's so much confusion about exactly what the House version contains and what the Senate version contains. It seems to me a lot of lawmakers are just going to vote this through and wait till the 2018 campaign to really work out where the American people stand.
A lot may do that. And you're not wrong, John, because you saw a dynamic to that similar in the House, right? Lots and lots of scared, hemming and hawing Republicans who said, I'm uncomfortable. Then when it came to it, they voted for right. it. That could happen here, except that the margins are getting really, really broad. We don't know what's going to happen with side deals, with amendments over this week. You heard Ron Johnson there mention the motion to proceed. That's a little bit of proceduralism from him, but you really want to keep your eyes. It's likely to be on Wednesday. We're going to get that CBO score today. It's going to be vital. Like I said, it will be bad news. The question is how bad, and can Mitch McConnell claw his way back to a deal here after that CBO score comes out? Then Wednesday, you heard Ron Johnson mention the motion to proceed. Mitch McConnell also can only lose two senators, not on the bill itself, but on a vote to get the bill on the floor in the first place. Ron Johnson there is saying, I haven't had enough time to even look at the impact of this. My constituents haven't had enough time. We're moving too fast. We know that you want to get this done by July 4th, but I might not even vote to put this thing on the floor, which means Mitch McConnell would have to take this bill into a July 4th recess and a longer summer on a bill that's going to have pretty low public support. The longer you go on a bill where the public is calling senators' offices, the less chance it has of passing.
Well, that's one vote. But the Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price was selling the bill pretty strongly on Sunday for the administration. And he claims that the CBO isn't really going to show that lots and lots of people are going to be losing coverage. I guess the question is, will the CBO number reconcile with what Tom Price said on Sunday on CNN?
The system, the plan that we have would put in place would not allow individuals to fall through the cracks, would not, we would not pull the rug out from under anybody, we would not have individuals lose coverage that they want for themselves and for their family. We want to make certain that health care is available to all Americans.
Is he talking about the Senate bill?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that he really is. You've seen quite a lot of this from Tom Price and from some other Republicans. They have set about attacking the integrity of the CBO because they know the score won't be on their side. As to the claim that individuals won't lose coverage, it is likely that the CBO score will directly contravene that statement. We don't know how many fewer people will have insurance under the Senate bill. It could be as high as 20 million, and there are lots and lots of analyses and tables and graphs you can go over online, John, to describe how costs, premiums, deductibles, and other costs for, say, a 60-year-old at 300% of poverty would go way up under the Senate bill. That's the policy that they've proposed here. And for Tom Price to say that individuals won't be affected, it isn't true.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
The national conversation about gun violence in America is changing. From abstract legal arguments about the Constitution to deeply emotional pleas for weapons bans in the wake of school killings, as was the case during the Obama years, there's another voice emerging, devoid of the political zealotry of the NRA or the anger and outrage of anti-gun activists. It's a simple plea to take on would-be killers directly.
Hi, my name's Jim Irvine, and I'd like to talk to you about how and why FASTER saves lives. FASTER is an acronym that stands for Faculty and Administrator Safety Training and Emergency Response. It's designed for our school staff and administrators to deal with active killers. It involves having a firearm in the schools by trained staff and medical supplies to treat injuries.
Irvine is president of the Buckeye Firearms Foundation in Ohio, which designed the FASTER training program.
Just as if you had a fire on your stove, you wouldn't call 911 and ask for the fire department and then just stand there and watch the fire burn. You would get your fire extinguisher out and do something in the moment.
Laura Carno is applying that logic to bring the FASTER training to Weld County, Colorado. 17 teachers and staff participated in a pilot program that's part of a deep shift in the gun debate in America. The response to the Alexandria attack this month that left Republican Congressman Steve Scalise in critical condition has been legislation to allow lawmakers to carry firearms virtually anywhere. And last month, it was reported that the number of citizen conceal and carry permits for firearms hit a record 15.7 million, with applications doubling or tripling in some states.
I look at the American mindset as we're not just going to fold our arms and kick the dirt and watch something terrible happen. We're going to do something about it.
In her case, Laura Carno started a nonprofit to fund firearms training in her state. She calls it Coloradans for Civil Liberties, and she organized last week's training event.
In Colorado, it is legal, if you have the permission of your school board, to be an armed first responder in your school. And many schools in Colorado, especially in the more rural areas, in the days after Sandy Hook, said, we have to do something. God forbid something like that happens here. The sheriff is a half hour away or 45 minutes away. So we are our own first responders.
All right. So the law in Colorado that you remind us of here means that someone who may be used to volunteering for their school for things like bake sales and ice cream socials can actually volunteer to be a first responder and bring a concealed weapon into that school. But I mean, not everyone who has the impulse to volunteer here is going to be helpful, and some may Sure. even be harmful. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, and there are several levels of approval they have here. So you've got a school employee who undergoes a background check to become a school employee. Then they get their concealed carry permit, and that's a different kind of background check. And then they have to be approved by their school board. So occasionally I'll hear, gosh, Mr. Jones in the math department shouldn't carry a gun. He once threw an eraser at a kid. Okay, well, Mr. Jones might not be approved by the school board if he has some sort of history of throwing erasers at kids. And I'd add to that, we're not seeing problems with this population, armed school staff. We're just not seeing problems. And if if all of these what ifs, like what if a student gets the gun? What if the teacher leaves it on the bathroom counter? They're just not happening.
Right.
And mistakes can happen, absolutely, but we're just not seeing them.
Well, what was the moment for you that this became a calling?
Yeah, and calling's a great word for that, John. I have worked in Second Amendment politics for a very long time. I have always believed that in order to stop a bad guy, we need a good guy as close as possible. When I was invited to go to this training last year in Ohio, and I'll tell you, I'm not a super emotional person. I'm more of a logical thinker. Going to this training was emotional for me. And it was because of the people I met who were attending the training. These are teachers, janitors, principals, whoever, who would put their body between bullets and kids. And this isn't their own kid, other people's kids. And one of the teachers had said to me, "We live in a broken world, hoping that a crazed madman isn't going to come through and hurt people, isn't going to stop him, but I'm a trained defender and I can stop him." And they come out of it very empowered that if something happens, they can step in and they can actually save lives. They don't have to be another Sandy Hook.
Laura, what would you advise a parent who still feels that the more guns you have in the school, the more insecure I'm going to be with my kid being there?
Yeah, they should talk to their school board and say, "This is an area of discomfort for me. I want my kids kept safe, but I don't want guns in schools." They need to make their position known. Just as the parents who feel closer to my position, that they think armed staff is a deterrent and can save their kids' lives. And then if there's a school that has armed staff next to a school that doesn't have armed staff, parents can pick, and I would encourage folks to create that choice in their communities and be very vocal with your schools.
Finally, I spent a lot of time living in Israel as a journalist back in the 1980s, and there's one of the most well-armed societies in the world in terms of people going to the army and that sort of thing. When there would be soft target terrorism in Israel, and civilians would come to the location with their own guns, ready to help out the authorities, there would often be civilian casualties, people who get caught in friendly fire. And, in a military situation, you say, all right, collateral damage, this is the deal, this is the risk that we take. Are we going to be able to say that in a school? If that happens?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And here's how I would answer that question. Many people say if we have more guns in schools in the hands of teachers or whomever, there's going to be kids caught in the crossfire. And I would answer them this way. There is nothing worse than a bad guy with a gun with nobody to stop him. Anything is better than that. I think every parent there would say, if there was somebody, some good guy in that building armed to stop that guy, could we have saved one child, two kids, five kids? And I think parents are willing to make that trade-off.
Laura Carno is the founder of Coloradans for Civil Liberties.
This is Donna from Winter Park, Florida. Arming school staff is not the answer. They would need to be heavily trained to be able to handle those rare situations professionally. If we arm school staff, should we arm nurses, camp counselors, daycare workers? Where would it end?
This is Alona from Athens. As a school employee, I do think we need more training. It would be nice to have another option besides hide and cower and hope that you're not discovered. Key employees ought to be trained to respond to the most likely scenarios in the event of a shooter. It is such a powerless feeling to have 30 children in a dark room looking to you, and you have nothing for them except your body between them and the door. It's really scary, and a little training and preparation would go a long way.
Do you think school staff should be armed and trained to take on active shooters? Tell us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. If there is anyone in the world who attracts as much attention and spectacle as President Donald Trump, it's possibly India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The Modi Show is back in the USA. It's on the road for the first in-person meeting between India's Modi and President Trump. The prime minister is expected to try to establish a personal rapport with the president while discussing trade, energy, and counterterrorism policy. And these are all tough issues right now. Joining us to discuss Prime Minister Modi's visit to D.C. is Tanvi Madan, director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Hello.
So, Tanvi, how would you rate Modi's concern about Trump actually being a good friend as he gets ready for a first face-to-face meeting with this new president, very different from Barack Obama?
I think he's waiting to find out, and that's one of the reasons to make this visit. There have been some questions in India about the timing of the visit, whether he should be even doing one right now. But I think he's a big believer in the power of personal diplomacy. And he will be partly trying to assess how much interest the president has in India, what he thinks of India and where it fits into his strategy, American strategy, but also want to get a sense of what he thinks about issues like China and Pakistan, which are important to India. I think the one other thing worth mentioning is that he does know that President Trump, despite some recent criticism of India on climate change, he's generally had fairly positive things to say about India. He's been there as well back in 2014, and he's had positive things to say about Prime Minister Modi as well.
From your analysis, you know, there's plenty on the record from President Trump talking about terrorism, about the relationship with China, about defense and energy sales in the Pacific. Would you say that any of that, and Afghanistan and Pakistan, not put too fine a point on it, I mean, is any of that policy already bumping up against concerns of India, even before the meeting starts?
I think on Afghanistan, Pakistan, there's very much kind of a sense of wonder or kind of wondering what the review that the administration is undertaking in terms of U.S. policy there, what that's going to mean for the U.S. role there, but also how the U.S. sees Pakistan. On terrorism, I think what Prime Minister Modi wants to see, and there's some concern about, is does the administration more broadly, but the president more specifically, take a global view of terror, that there has to be counterterrorism action against not just groups like the Haqqani Network that are attacking U.S. and Afghan interests in Afghanistan, but also Pakistan-based terror groups that are attacking India. So he'll want to know that it's global view of terrorism, not just ISIS, not just the Haqqani Network, but also on these other groups. So there have been some concerns. I think the more defense and security cooperation has been going fairly well, even in the first 6 months of the Trump administration. It's the economic side that there have been more frictions on.
Modi apparently wants drones from Donald Trump, which is the defense part. Is there a real extent to which India and the U.S. can reconcile this $30.8 billion trade deficit with the U.S.? There are lots of projects that Modi has always wanted to do. And finally, just to button it up here, Ken Juster has been appointed to replace Richard Verma as the ambassador to India. How's that playing in Delhi?
So on the defense side, I think, you know, this is an area which is win-win for both sides. India has gone from buying about contracts worth $1 billion in 2008 in terms of defense purchases from the U.S. to $15 billion more recently. And so this is an area that American defense companies, particularly those that are producing here, think is a major area of cooperation. The Indians have been wanting this, the approval for this drone sale, and it looks like it's coming through. It could mean anywhere from $2 billion to $3 billion of a sale for an American company. And so I think this is a win-win. Just very briefly, I think the Indians are kind of looking forward to, if Ken Juster is nominated and confirmed, they'll look forward to him. He's a known quantity, which is key for them at a time of many, many uncertainties.
All right. Well, an expectation of stability in the relationship between India and the United States as Narendra Modi meets Donald Trump. Tanvi Madan is director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting the original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. When a celebrity sex tape is leaked, a high-stakes legal battle between Gawker and former professional wrestler Hulk Hogan leads to the gossip site's ruin. Nobody Speak explores the shadowed world of billionaires manipulating free speech, ultimately revealing what power and money can do in undermining democracy. Now streaming only on Netflix.
It may seem incongruous with all the talk of non-citizens being untrustworthy border crossers these days to realize that more than 11,000 non-citizens are given guns by the U.S. military and permitted to serve in the U.S. Army. Most are legal immigrants or green card holders who permanently live in the United States. They fight side by side with fellow soldiers, putting their lives on the line defending the United States, and are treated like any other soldier. But non-citizen soldiers who get in trouble with the law after service can find themselves on their way out of the country rather than farther down the path towards citizenship. Dorian Marina is a reporter for station KPCC in Los Angeles and is a contributor to the American Homefront Project. He brings us the first of his two-part series on veteran deportations.
Mario Martinez tugs a cardboard box into his dining room. He pulls out a paper with a child's drawing of flowers. It's from his granddaughter.
She's 5 now, 5 years old.
Next to the painting is what he's looking for, his discharge papers from the U.S. Army.
Yeah, and this is from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where I was at. It was part of the 82nd Airborne Division.
The box holds documents from his military life, including his deployment in the late 1980s to Germany, where he was sent with the 3rd Armored Division to guard the Berlin Wall. It was a heady time, he says, and as an immigrant from Mexico, he saw himself as part of a force protecting America's security.
I've served this country honorably in the military. I got an honorable discharge. I would have been willing to die for this country, the only place I call my home.
But more than a decade after he left the Army, he was convicted of assault in a domestic violence case. It happened the night he found the body of his best friend, who had died by suicide. Martinez says he was upset and got into an argument with his girlfriend. He served 4 years in prison and says he regrets what he did.
One mistake shouldn't make the rest of your life. I mean, I paid for what I did. I did my time. I did it quietly and went in, did my time, got out. Isn't that punishment enough?
For U.S. citizens, the prison term would have been the end of it. But Martinez, who is now 54, is facing deportation under a longstanding federal law. It allows the government to deport even legal immigrants who commit crimes, and that includes immigrants who are veterans. Jenny Pasquarella is an attorney with the ACLU.
The fact that that person gave willingly their life to defend this country should be an extraordinary factor that the government considers when seeking a punishment as severe as deportation and, in many cases, permanent separation from their families.
Last year, Pasquarella looked at more than 80 cases of deported veterans. She found that many thought they automatically became citizens through their service. Others applied for naturalization only to have their paperwork lost.
In fact, we had multiple people say that they didn't know that they weren't a U.S. citizen until literally they were being put on that plane to be deported, or they were facing that immigration judge.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it does take military service into account. The agency says official policy is to have senior leadership at the local field office sign off before deporting a veteran. But an executive order signed by President Trump in January expands who can be deported. Already, immigrant arrests are up by a third compared to last year. And not everyone agrees that veterans should be protected from deportation. Donnie Youngblood is the sheriff in Kern County, California, and the president of the California Sheriff's Association.
Even under the Obama administration, 3 misdemeanors and you were able to be deported. So I have mixed emotions because I am a veteran, but I certainly empathize with the victim more than anyone.
Youngblood does propose a solution: grant citizenship to immigrants who serve in the military. The Pentagon says it's taking steps in that direction by making it easier for troops to get naturalized. They say that's helped decrease the number of non-citizens in the military from about 35,000 in 2005 to just over 11,000 today. While the changes come too late for vets like Mario Martinez, he says other veterans have earned the right to become Americans.
These people gave up a lot for your freedom. Obviously, some had criminal records, but they're still people, and they serve this country honorably to maintain the standard of life that you currently have.
Martinez's next court date is 2020, and he's trying to rebuild his life. He recently moved into a new home with his son in Southeast LA, but the government could make him a priority for deportation at any time. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Part 2 of Dorian Marina's series airs tomorrow, and it takes us to Tijuana. Last week, we reported on Immigration and Customs Enforcement's plan to discontinue a program intended to keep women and children out of detention. Today, a look at the ICE facilities where families and their children might end up, called Family Residential Centers. There are three of them in the U.S., Burke's Family Residential Center in Berks County, Pennsylvania, the Carnes Residential Center in Carnes City, Texas, run by the private prison company Geo Group, and the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas, run by a private prison company, CoreCivic. The facilities hold women and children. They get federal reimbursement dollars for each detainee they hold. Their use was expanded in 2014 under the Obama administration in response to the tens of thousands of women and children from Central America seeking refuge in the U.S. in that year. But the scale-up has been brutal and chaotic, and it is only expected to get worse under the aggressive policies of ICE under President Trump. Amanda Doroshow is a staff attorney at Her Justice, who's visited the South Texas Residential Center in Dilley a number of times, last time in December of 2016, as part of a volunteer attorney program with the CARA Family Detention Project. She has seen confusion, long waits, no access to lawyers, and inhumane conditions.
The South Texas Family Residential Center has, I think, 2,400 beds. You go for a week at a time, and I say every time I come back, I need a good 3 weeks to get back to where I was. I was intensively for 12, 15 hours a day talking to women and children that had been raped, that had family members murdered, that are fleeing violence. And many times I was the first person that they had ever spoken to about this.
And these were people, just to be clear, they were raped in the facility, or they were raped and that was why they were asking for asylum? What sort of circumstances are you talking about?
So in these situations, the people detained, the women and children detained, were refugees fleeing their home country, fleeing rape or gang violence or other gender-based violence, and seeking asylum, which they have the legal right to do here in the U.S. And so the first thing that they have to do in this long, tedious process to claim asylum, they have to pass something called a credible fear interview. And that's with an asylum officer. And that's where they have to articulate themselves in a compelling way their fears of returning to the home country. That was one thing I was doing with people a lot, talking to them about their claims, helping prepare them to go in for this interview.
What's the situation for healthcare and general comfort in the facility that you visited?
It's sick and it's horrific, to put it lightly. You know, I knew it was going to be a bad situation when I went there for the first time, and this exceeded anything I could have ever imagined.
But what do you say to people who say, well, she was just in a visitor trailer, she doesn't know what she's talking about?
Well, the visitor trailer is part of the detention center. So people come in from the detention center and they're telling us about the situation. And I saw people with my own two eyes. So, for example, all of the children were unbelievably sick. They were vomiting, they had diarrhea, and all the children had this severe, severe cough that I remember I would put my hands on the back of a 3 or 4 year old and I could feel their lungs rattle when they breathed. I was told when I arrived not to drink the water there because it was rumored to be contaminated from fracking.
Who told you that?
The project. And I also, there was some of the workers that worked for CoreCivic said to me as well, we don't drink the water.
The prison facility said, we don't drink the water that the detainees drink.
Correct. The CoreCivic workers that when I was going through security, they said, we don't even drink the water. However, there is a huge jug of tap water in the detention center. And when I would ask a mother if their child who had gotten medical treatment, they would say that they went to the doctor and there would be two responses. One response would be, all I got was a Vicks cough drop and was advised to drink more water, or I don't understand what the doctor did to my child because they didn't speak my language and there wasn't an interpreter.
What are the requirements for availability of healthcare at facilities like these under the law, if there is any?
I can't speak to this fully, but I do know for family detention centers where you're detaining children, there's something called the Flores Settlement of 1997. And that kind of outlines the requirements that immigration must comply with in order to detain children. I believe there are requirements in there and there needs to be access to medical care. One of the other requirements is that the detention center needs to be a child care facility. But in this case, the South Texas Family Residential Center has never been a licensed child care facility.
What's the worst thing you saw or were told about in terms of conditions for children at the Dilley facility?
Here's an example of what I saw. It was, I met with a woman and a 6-year-old girl The 6-year-old girl was raped in her home country, and the mother reported the rape to the police, and now their lives are being threatened. So they fled here seeking asylum. Since the 6-year-old girl had been raped, she could not stop urinating herself. But by the time she got to the detention center, and when I spoke with the mother, she had received no medical care, no psychological support. And on top of that, now she had diarrhea and was vomiting and had this cough that every child had. Another incident I saw was my very first day was a volunteer walked in to find a 4-year-old unconscious on the floor. The 4-year-old was in the children's room, which is supposed to be supervised, but it was unsupervised. No one was there, so no one had any idea how long this child had been unconscious for. And I remember looking around and seeing how it was just looked like this was a normal thing that happened. And I remember thinking to myself, how is this 4-year-old being found unconscious a typical scenario? Like, when is this going to stop when you find a 4-year-old dead on the floor? Because that's how horrific it was.
Are there reforms taking place at this facility? Is the facility itself trying to deal with some of these problems? Would you describe it as overcrowded, at capacity, generally speaking?
I mean, one thing I do remember when I was there the last time was there were delays in people's releases. So what happened is people had a positive, credible fear interview, meaning you meet the first step to be released to file for asylum, and they had that decision, yet they were still sitting in the detention center over Christmas, a week, 2 weeks later, waiting to be released. And immigration's response essentially was, you know, people are on vacation. We can't process people fast enough. So why are you detaining people after they've already met the minimum requirement to be released? A lot of these egregious human rights violations, these things have been going on. A lot of this started under the Obama era. This detention center started in 2014. And that's one of the scariest things for me, the talk now of expanding these things.
Amanda Doroshow is a staff attorney at Heard Justice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Immigration lawyers told The Takeaway last week that the South Texas Family Residential Center continues to hold children despite not having a child care license. We reached out to ICE for comment on this story. Regarding the water issue, they directed us to contact the city of Dilley. The city did not respond. And as for the conditions, ICE points to a June 2nd report from the Office of the Inspector General about family detention centers. Quote, the Inspector General stated that contrary to the complaints filed by various immigrant rights advocates organizations, ICE addressed satisfactorily the inherent challenges of providing medical care, language services, and ensuring the safety of families in detention. ICE remains committed to ensuring its facilities adhere to ICE's detention standards, which provide several levels of oversight in order to ensure that residents in ICE custody reside in safe, secure, and humane environments.
Everybody tried to make us feel like this is the biggest night of our entire lives.
Foo Fighters played Glastonbury this weekend, a mere 130,000 people singing Dave's song. Now, you wouldn't imagine that most moms ever get the experience of sitting behind a curtain and watching tens of thousands of fans in a worshipful frenzy over their sons. But Virginia Hanlon Grohl, mother to Foo Fighters leader Dave Grohl, has had that experience countless times. Even in the old days, when Dave was drummer for the band Nirvana, she got to experience her own motherly Nirvana while wearing earplugs. Now in her 70s, Virginia has watched and wondered how other parents navigated the journey to fame for their talented and in some cases troubled children. In her book, From Cradle to the Stage, Virginia talked with 18 moms of famous musicians and discovered many were single moms just like her.
I was a single parent teacher working several jobs. And so we weren't rolling in money. David always says that was one of the great benefits. He grew up not having very much and not needing very much.
What were you most curious about other moms? What were the questions that you had about yourself that maybe you wanted to see if there was a pattern here, something like that?
I did. I didn't have a lot of agenda, but I was curious about where the tough times were, where the breakaway times where something really was decided or happened, and I really found them. For example, I found that at the age of 12 to 13, almost all of our little rockers determined absolutely that there was no question about what life was going to be for them. It was going to be music, and there was no changing that from that point on. And that surprised me. Not many people know at 12 what their life's work is going to be. It surprised me.
Can I just ask, what's the father situation in your family and Dave's sort of father connection?
I know. I felt sort of bad just almost acting as if he'd never happened. And of course he did. And we were divorced when David was really young, I think maybe 8 or 9, something like that. And his father was a writer, a political writer in Washington. And he also had been a classical musician. He wasn't so crazy about the kind of music David was playing and thought it was a waste of time and didn't get on board for a long time. It took it took Nirvana to convince him that his son had any talent.
Yeah, Nirvana, huh?
And they had a meeting of the minds at some point, you know, towards the end. There were some difficult times. There was a lot of conflict, but they met in the middle after a few years.
As a journalist, I really admire your work in investigating the experience of Amy Winehouse's parents.
Oh,
can you tell me about that experience?
Yes, that was startling. I read several books about Amy before I went to visit her mother. And we met in London in her garden. And she was assisted to the chair. She has a cane now. She has multiple sclerosis. And sat down, smiling and bright, and just amazed me with her recollections. And she is the most optimistic woman I've ever met. She has been through the most horrible years and refuses to let that say to her that everything is bleak and horrible. She has a bright outlook on everything and looks forward to the next day, the next week. She's unbelievable.
I think the Amy Winehouse experience connects directly to your direct experience with Kurt Cobain and what happened in that band. And how you talk about the media a lot, but how sad was it to watch someone have such a gift that it really was almost too heavy to bear, even given the media's excesses?
It was. And it was doubly difficult because of that intrusion. It was difficult for David because people were poking at him with, tell us this, tell us that. That was a very short, very dramatic time. And his mother and I agreed. She didn't want to do the traditional interview story kind of thing. But she said, I do want you to tell those few things you tell me that I love hearing about him. And that's what I did. So I just took exactly the things that she loved to hear and wrote those. And, you know, one was the conversation in my living room where he sort of separated himself from the group and sat behind everybody. And I joined him and we talked about Dandelion Mine and some other books that were on the shelf. And it was just a really pleasant conversation. And it wasn't about music and it wasn't about the craziness outside. It was just talking about books. And there were, you could have those moments, but they were very rare.
So did you have any thoughts when you met all these moms of maybe putting together a famous mom band?
Well, I do have a song in mind that I want us all to entertain our sons and daughters with. I'm going to write sort of an anthem in the probably a take-up on We Are the World kind of thing, where they're all the voices, and we are the moms, and sing and serenade them with that. If I can ever get us all together, I want to get us all together around a dinner table, because they're dying to meet each other. They haven't met each other, and then maybe we'll sing for everybody.
That sounds great. I'd come to that concert.
Good. We'll get
I bet Dave would be the backup band.
I hope so.
Virginia, thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Virginia Grohl is the mother of Dave Grohl, frontman for the Foo Fighters and former drummer for Nirvana. Her book, From Cradle to the Stage, Stories from the Mothers Who Rocked and Raised Rock Stars, came out earlier this year. Finally today, a life-changing milestone. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States affirmed the nationwide right of same-sex couples to get married.
This morning, the Supreme Court recognized that the Constitution guarantees marriage equality. In doing so, they've reaffirmed that all Americans are entitled to the equal protection of the law.
In recall of that moment, Gardena, California says, I'm married now to the man I've lived with for almost 30 years. My nephew is married to his partner. This law legitimized our relationships.
This is Lisa. I live in Charleston, South Carolina now. The Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage has made the best possible difference in our family. My beloved stepson was married to his amazing partner, now husband, in late May, just a few weeks ago. And it has brought another wonderful young man into our blended family.
Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm from Austin, Texas. Since the Supreme Court decision, we've had scores of friends able to marry, even in our own home state, and we are so delighted about this. I never thought it would be possible in Texas, so hooray!
My name is Laura Zucker. I'm calling from Lafayette, California. The decision on marriage equality was revolutionary in my life. I married my partner following that decision, and that was something that I never, ever thought possible in my lifetime. So, right on, Supreme Court, it had a profound impact on me and my family.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.